draw your attention to this evening relates to where we left off to a certain extent last week, and we're again in the middle, towards the beginning still, I guess, of Perek Beis. Again, it's a little bit not out of order, but we have already a perspective of most, if not all, of the Perek, because we did that introductory shiur 2 weeks ago from Rav Soloveitchik, and the fact that the whole narrative of the second Perek is so intertwined and confusing. We have the beginning of Adam Arishon, and then we have a break for the garden, and then we have the rivers, and then we have naming the animals, and then we have Chava, and then we have Krit. It's a confusing parak, and we address that in a very holistic... I have some more sheets here if you need. We address that in an overview, and we're now going through it a little bit more definitively and a little bit more slowly. So in light of that, we have been exposed to some of these psukim, but moving back, I did want to focus today a little bit on Eitz HaChaim, but primarily on the Eitz HaDa'as. Now, the truth is that some of the stuff we're going to do, I really would have thought perhaps to hold back until we get to Perek Gimel, which is what Adam and Chava eat from the Eitz HaDa'as, and everything flows negatively, unfortunately, from that. But nevertheless, since we are introduced to the Eitz HaDa'as here in Perek Beis, and more to the point, some of the significant Makaros are in Perek Beis. A lot is in Perek Gimel of the Mefarshim understanding the Eitz HaDa'as. And you'll see the last thing we're going to get to tonight is what was the Eitz HaDa'as? What does it mean? What was it? What was this, not only what was it actual as a species, which we'll get to in the beginning of this year, but what was the significance of the Eitz HaDa'as, which the Torah very ambiguously or mysteriously ascribes to us? Now, needless to say, that is very, very much connected to, well, what happened to Adam and Chava after they ate it. And that's why, in a sense, I would have loved to have done that all as one unit and perhaps held off until then. But the truth is, since the Mefarshim already speak about the characteristics, both spiritual and physical, of the Eitz HaDa'as here in Perek Beis, as well as since we're going to have a break, I think it's an important piece to do now. And Emir Tashem in the fall, when we get to Perek Gimel and discuss the actual chait of Adam and Chava, not only what we have to understand, what was the chait, which is, of course, one of the ancient questions of all of religion, but specifically what happened to them, what were they like as people before the sin, and what occurred to them, how did they change after the sin, which the Torah already hints at, yes, which the Torah hints at in its descriptions of Perek Gimel. So that is something which I hope will be enlightened by what we discuss now, and hopefully we'll all remember it, and if not, we'll review it when we get to it. But in terms of the actual description, both biologically and spiritually, of the Eitz HaDa'as, I think now is the place to really focus on that. So if you'll take a look back again in Perek Beis, look at Pasuk Ches. Again, to review, we've seen these psukim, we've analyzed them inside and out from a variety of perspectives already. Perek Zayin talked about the creation of Adam himself, and Pasuk Ches then moves in. Pasuk Ches then moves into the creation of the garden. Again, for those who are just coming in, the fact that this seems to be a hopscotch, Adam, then the garden, and we're going to get back to Chava, so that is mysterious, it's worth analysis, and in fact, that was the subject of our shiur 2 weeks ago. But now we're not looking at the pattern, or the overall parak, we're looking at these psukim in isolation. Yita Hashem Elohim Gan Be'eden Mikedem. So now we're standing the fact that we all refer to it as Gan Eden. The truth is that the Torah's description is Gan Be'eden. There was a place called Eden, and there was a garden in Eden. And in that garden, Hashem planted, implanted to a certain extent Adam. But Yasam Hashem Es Adam. He planted or he moved this Adam, Asher Yasar, which he had already created. What is Mikedem? So we discussed that last week. Is it referring to a geographical location in the eastern part of the garden? Or perhaps as a theological significance, some of Farshim say Mikedem means beforehand. Namely, perhaps that the garden was created on the third day, even though Adam himself wasn't created on the sixth day. But we have first now, for the first time in Pasuk Ches, we're introduced to the garden, and we now know that there is Adam there. However, you know, it wouldn't be... What is an essential characteristic of a garden is not that there's a human being there. What's an essential characteristic of a garden? There's certain vegetation, right? Certain flowers or trees there. So that's what the Torah continues with. Yisra Hashem Elokim min ha'adama kol eitz nechmad l'ma'areh v'tov l'ma'achal. And Hashem caused to grow from this ground any beautiful, delicious tree, beautiful to observe, delicious to eat. What is the idea of a Yitzmach Hashem Elokim, that Hashem did it? So again, we discussed that last week. We saw different mafarshim, and perhaps the most interesting answer was that Yitzmach Hashem, that at least at this point, a person's parnasa, the ability to sustain themselves to eat, was without tsar. It was the Radak, if I remember correctly, who said that. The Sforno. Thank you, Ellie. That this idea of Yitzmach Hashem is that Hashem did it, and therefore it came almost, even though it was a physical reality, but it had a certain supernatural ability to sustain itself and replicate itself, even if Adam would have been eating all the fruits of these particular trees. Nevertheless, it was all there. The other explanation, which was also very interesting, we saw from the Ramban, was that even though throughout the rest of the world, the pattern of tree growth or other vegetation may be somewhat random. Hashem may say, I want Yellowstone Park to have lots of trees, but that this tree should be there and that tree should be there, that the Ramban says is random. Again, I'm not sure that every Mefarsh would agree or not with that. That's getting into major issues of Hashem's involvement in the world. But the Ramban, who's generally known to have a very strong Hashkacha Pratis approach, unlike the Ramban sees Hashem very much involved in activities, and we mentioned that as a spin-off of that Ramban, the Sfasem is in a famous comment, basically, and others like the Sfasem also mentioned how Hashem tells each leaf when to drop and presumably when to grow. And I just suggested, even though we're not investigating it further, that perhaps this Ramban is not going as far as the Sfasem is, because he speaks about most places being somewhat random. Yet, nevertheless, says the Ramban, that should be contrasted with the Gan Be'eden, or these trees, namely that the Yitzmach Hashem. Every single tree in the Gan, not just the two we're about to get to, but every single tree in the Gan, all these that were beautiful to look at and all these that were delicious to taste, every one of them, Hashem intently said, you're going to be here and you're going to be there and you're going to be there. All of that now provides a context for the culmination and the climax of this pasuk, which is what we're focused on tonight, namely, the Eitz HaChaim B'soch HaGan. There was a tree called the Tree of Life, which is in the middle of the garden, the Eitz Hadas, Tov Vara. And a tree of knowledge, what is knowledge apparently? Knowledge of Tov Vara. Tov Vara. So it's interesting, I haven't seen, unless, tell me someone here, maybe if you're familiar, I didn't see any of the Mefarshim who wanted to know what is the species of Eitz HaChaim. Is anyone familiar with the discussion about that? You familiar? Yes. Not the Eitz Hadas, Eitz HaChaim. We're going to get to the Eitz Hadas. That's my point. In other words, there's a famous medrash we're going to get to in a moment that discusses what was the species of the Eitz Hadas. But I'm not sure. I didn't see anybody who discusses what is the Eitz HaChaim. I'm not sure why that should be so. Homework. Okay? See, the school's over. Ketino kagob habarech. Mi beis ha-sefer. In the Chazal's famous terms, we're in the end of the summer. But perhaps summer reading. I know the schools are very
good. The reason is...
Yeah.
In Pasuk Yud Zayin, it's interesting, you have these two trees, but it's only from the Eitz Hadas he's told he came. So maybe that's why you want to know what the species is.
Okay, but I mean, shouldn't we just be curious?
Yeah, I'm just...
Okay, well, maybe the Mefarshim and Perek in Pasuk Yud Zayin mentioned it there. I didn't look in Pasuk Yud Zayin. I was just looking in the Mefarshim on this Pasuk.
No, because Yud Zayin only talks about...
Right. Okay.
So we're... Who cares what it is?
Okay, so... Right. So here, Bernie's already assuming that there is no explanation. Perhaps that's the reason. There is no description, and maybe that's the explanation of why there's no description. But in case, you just put it in the back of your mind. If anyone ever comes across something, please look me up. Let me know what it is. I would be curious.
There are other discussions that say, Hashem is worried that he could eat from the Eitz HaChaim also, after he eats rice and that.
Okay, please, as I say, if anyone comes across, please let me know. Okay. But as I did allude to, there is a famous discussion in Chazal as to what was the specific species, what was the biological reality, what was this tree of knowledge, the Eitz Hadas. So let's take a look at this medrash. I find it fascinating and interesting on a few levels. One level, which I'm not sure, and maybe this should be the most important one, is, and please keep this in mind as we're learning the medrash, and I'm curious if there's any thoughts that you have, which is, l'mai nafkamina? Who cares? That's a question that may be lurking in the back of your mind as we see this medrash. I think it's a fair question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. Other than we want to know, because we always want to know. But is there a significant... And the fact that there's going to be different opinions, Nitin Lidarish, presumably there's what to say, and I didn't take a look to see if those elaborate. There are those who elaborate, and I haven't really given enough thought myself. But I would be curious, really, if any of you have thoughts on what perhaps the different significances may be, or is it just a question of, fact? We're like a scientist, so to speak, and we just want to classify and we want to know. It may be that, and it's important maybe in that sense, but maybe there's something more. Let's keep that also in the back of our mind. So the Medrash asks us very directly, what was that tree? And we know the Eitz Hadaas, even though we haven't gotten up to Parag Gimel in this class. A few of us have, if we haven't read the book, we've seen the movie. So we know that the Adam and Chava ate from the Tree of Knowledge. That's going to be in Parag Gimel. So the Medrash already here on our pasuk, this is a Medrash on Parag Beis, asks, what was that tree? It is interesting that the Medrash phrases it that way. The Medrash doesn't say, what was Eitz Hadaas? It asks, what was the tree that they ate from? So perhaps it's already telling you that, in some ultimate sense, the reason that we care is because this is the one that changes the course of all humanity. That's what's relevant. If it had just been a tree somewhere, wouldn't have been as important to us. So Rabbi Meir is of the first opinion. Rabbi Meir Omer, chitim hayu. It was actually a stalk of wheat. A stalk of wheat. Now, what's the most obvious problem with this theory? It's not a tree, right? So the Medrash is going to note that. First, before we bomb Rav Meir into submission, let's first see how he proactively defends himself. As he says, he quotes like an idiom, an Aramaic idiom, like a saying, Kad lo hava barnash dea inun amrin. There is this idiom that is said about those who don't have knowledge. What are people who don't have knowledge? Hu insha pita dechite min yome. This is lo achal, insha pita dechite min yome. That someone who doesn't have knowledge is someone who doesn't eat some bread made of wheat on a daily basis. So the fact, this is his assumption, there's this Aramaic idiom out there that associates knowledge some with wheat, and therefore it's critical of someone who's a non-knowledgeable person, a boor, an imbecile, is someone who's not having this wheat on a daily basis. So, needless to say, it's not the strongest offense. Right? The best defense is a good offense, but this is not the greatest offense. And therefore, the Medrash right away goes on the attack. Shmuel, Yitzhak, Boi, Kamei, Rabbi Zera. Is it really, really possible? Efshar, Chitim, Hayu? I mean, could it really be that there was Chitim? I mean, come on. Amar lo, hey, yes, why not? Why not? So they says, well, if you're going to make me, I will tell you. Amar lo, if a hog said eats, isn't it described as a tree? Amar lo, matmoros hayu ka'arze levano. Apparently it wasn't just stam a stalk, a little yingle of stalk that you see when you're driving through the country and you see the wheat farm. It was a super duper gazunta stalk. Ka'arze Alvanon, right? Like the cedars of Lebanon, the super duper, like those trees in Yellowstone. This was this stalk of wheat. So since it was so tall, it can be, Rav Meir says, accurately referred to as an eitz. That is Rav Meir's opinion. Okay. Now the Medrash moves on to a second opinion. Rav Yehuda bar Eli Amar, anovim hayu, grapes. Right, grapes, like a vineyard, right? Well, you don't, right? Exactly, but that's what he says. It's interesting, that's not the question that's asked on him, but that is what he suggests. Shene Amar, Nivemo, Eberush, it is the pasuk here in Ha'azinu, speaks about, it's very poetic as part of that whole song, how there are certain, Rush, like it's a galling, a certain negative or bitter type of anavim, Eshkolos mroros lamo, and we therefore give them some kind of a bitter eshkolos, and it's a very interesting, that's interesting maybe because I'm not sure I understand it, but the limud, so to speak, the matter suggests is osan eshkolos heviu mroros laolam. Here the Medrash is speaking about first anavim, and then it's the pasuk speaking about anavim, then it's speaking about bitter eshkolos, and in a very, very creative drash. So he's reading it that these bitter eshkolos were brought to the world, the implication being by the Cheda Adam. Had Adam never sinned, we would have been in a good path. If you'll take a look at that pasuk in Ha'azinu, it's very complicated because there's a major machlokus of the Mefarshim with Rashi and others. Is that pasuk referring to the Umos Ha'olam, the non-Jews, and why they're bad? And in that case, this particular trush makes no sense. Or as another group of Mishparshim refer to that particular pasuk as it's referring to when the Jewish people are misbehaving. So in that light, this medrash is basically saying Jewish people being good or bad is already a more macrocosm of the more specific original example, the microcosm of Adam himself. Before Adam was, if Adam had never been bad, then there would never have been this eshkozmer, there wouldn't have been these bitter clusters. Clusters, again, even, you know, that's the connection to grapes. So, if the fact that there's bitter clusters is connected to grapes, so there must be the only reason we can ever have anything bitter in life is because Adam sinned, so it must be that it was the grapes that brought the bitterness to the world. Okay. Could be. Not overwhelming. Okay. Third opinion. Rabbi Abba de Akko. Amar, Rabbi Abba of Akko said, Esrog Haya. Esrog, the citron, the same esrog we take on Sukkot. This is the esrog that was in the Eitz Hadas. Hadahu d'chsiv, that's the hey dal. We've had that as an abbreviation in Medrash many times. Hey dal ha'hadu d'chsiv, as it is written in Bereishis Paragimel Pasuk Vav. Tera isha kitov ha'etz. Right, we're going to get to this, right? When Chava is being seduced into eating from the tree, she sees how yummy and delicious the eitz is. So the Medrash says, Tere, ezo ilan, she'etzo nechol kipriyo. Shouldn't she have said the fruit of the tree? Not the tree. The tree is not delicious. It must be that the tree itself is delicious. And what tree is delicious like its fruit? Einatamotze ela esrog. This is an esrog. In fact, this is a halacha. And some of you may recall, I gave a drasha on this halacha this past Sukkot. One of my Sukkot drashas in shul was based on the Gemara in Masechah Sukkah, which learns that one of the halachos that when the Gemara is trying to determine, again, just as a Sukkot drasha, to just remind you, right, where in the Torah does it tell you that you're supposed to take an esrog? That's not an esrog. So that's the point. The Torah never says the word esrog. The Torah says priyetz hadar. So there's a Mesorah balpeh going back forever, that it's an esrog. But often you have a phenomenon in Tarsha Baal Peh when there is an undisputed oral tradition, but it's not obviously grounded in any particular text or pasuk. So very often in those phenomena, you will have a machlokes in the Gemara or the Mishnah, which is what I call a theoretical machlokes. Namely, they're all agreeing on the point. It's not a machlokes like, yes, you're allowed to do barer on Shabbos, and no, you're not allowed to shell peanuts on Shabbos. That's a real practical machlokas. This is what I'm calling a theoretical machlokas, that they're all agreeing with the end game. The end game is that it's supposed to be that esrog on Sukkot. We have different opinions as to where we know that from. So one of the opinions is this idea of pre-eitz hadar. It's implying that it's even the eitz is hadar, even the, not just that the pre is hadar, but the eitz is hadar, not just that the fruit is beautiful or delicious, but even the tree. And the Gemara gives this exact same drasha. What other example is there where, and as I mentioned that, it's not so much the bark, it's actually referring to the skin. I haven't tested that empirically either. But it's not referring so much to the bark, it's referring actually to the skin of the esrog. That's the tradition that Chazal have, and that's how we identify, at least according to one opinion, that the esrog is the one. Just as a parallel example, just to broaden our general horizons. What is one of, if not the, another example, maybe the most famous example, where you have a Mesorah, clearly a tradition that Chazal had, but it's very confusing in the text, and you have many opinions, all agreeing with the conclusion, but arguing about how you get there. Well, it's not that long ago. It's a calendaric phenomenon, which was not that long ago. In the spring. What'd you say? Sfiras Omer. When do you start counting Sfiras Omer? How do you know that? What does the Torah tell you? Mimacharas HaShabbos. From the day after Shabbos. Now, what does that typically mean? When's the day after Shabbos? Sunday! So who said it's Sunday? The Tzedukim said it's Sunday. So Chazal had an unimpeachable, or should say unimpeachable, theoretically I guess it could have been, but an undisputed, in our tradition, undisputed Mesorah, that despite what the Pasuk says, it doesn't mean the day after Shabbos, it means the day after the first day of Pesach, i.e. that second night. So you have in the Gemara Menachos, a 5, 6, 7-way debate, I don't remember exactly, many opinions, argue about how we know, how do we derive, or I'll use the big English word, what is the exegesis? How do we know that really it means that? We know that it means that, but how do we know that? So you have a 7-way debate, but what's so obvious from that 7-way debate? There's not a single opinion of the 7, or whatever it is, that says it's not on the second day. No one says it's on Sunday. Right? So what's going on there? It's clear as day what's going on there. The same phenomenon as here. We have a Masorah, what the halacha is. It's supposed to be the second day of Pesach. And we're just trying to figure out where that comes from. So similarly, Priyei Tzadar, we have a Masorah, it's an Esrog, and there's different opinions in the Gemara how we know that. One of those opinions is very much akin to exactly what this opinion here in the Medrash says. It's that the characteristic of the Esrog, that its outer shell and its inner shell have similar taste, that is a unique phenomenon to the Esrog, which may be relevant to the holiday of Sukkot, and according to this opinion in the Medrash, is so important that it actually serves as the key identifying characteristic which proves that it was none other than the fruit of the Eitz Hadas. And the fourth and final opinion that gives a specific character species to it, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Te'enim Hayu, was figs. How do we know it's figs? This is very interesting. This is the only, if you will, logical deduction of the three of the four opinions. Davar Lamed Mi'inyono. We can deduce it. And I'll give you a mashal, he says, right? A story is always good, a parable. Leben Sarim, this was the son of the king, or the son of the prince, you know, of the lord, shekilkilim achas min hashepchos. He misbehaved with one of the maidservants. Came with shama hasar, terdu b'hotziyo chutz lapalten. He got very angry at his son, and he threw him out of the palace. V'haya, so what does the son do? Nebuchadnezzar, he's got to beg now. Haya machazer al petcheihen shal shepchos. He went around. Maybe they had a neighborhood where the commoners lived, where the other maidservants lived, and that clad, and he went around asking, please take me in and support me. And none of them wanted him, right? He brought disgrace on one of their friends. They didn't want to take him in. Until he finally got to her house, his true love apparently, at least when he needed her, she was his true love. And, you know, this wouldn't be the first woman who was gullible enough to fall for a lover's charms. And, oh, yeah, you're the first person. I ran right to your door. Please let me in. And apparently she took him in. So, says Rabbi Yossi, that is a mashal to how he knows that it's figs. Where does he go from there? Kach, so too here. V'shosh achol Adam ha-rishon me'osa ilon. We know that in Perek Gimel, Adam's can eat from this tree. What happened? The parallel. Hashem kicks him out of Gan Eden. He's running around to the different trees for help. So they don't help him. What did they say to him? Why didn't they help him? You're a ganef, they told Adam. The ganef died to Devarye. Right? Hashem made a deal with you. I'm going to put you in the gan if you don't eat from these trees. And you disobeyed, you went back on your word. You didn't agree, you didn't do what Hashem expected you to do. So none of the trees would help him. But the fig, which is the fruit that he had eaten from, in a sense, figuratively opened its doors and took him in. Namely, and that's what the pasuk is referring to. When it says about how, what? That they took the leaves of the figs. Allah Ta'ala, they took that right to cover themselves. They took it to cover themselves. Why is it that, basically what this opinion is saying, why is that of all things in the Gan, why does Adam and Chava take fig leaves to cover themselves? Why not some other? So says the Medrash, very allegorically, because other trees and other flowers don't want to help them. Why all of a sudden the Tehena doesn't care about Geneva? Because the Tehena was already softened to the charms of Adam and Chava, because you know they were flattered. You disobeyed Hashem to eat my fruit. That's a little flattering. So that, so to speak, just like the one particular shifcha took in this prince, so too the Teina helped him. So that's a very creative, illustrative, and parable. Is there any textual basis for such a thing? Not really. So we have Rabbi Meir who says, it could be wheat. Because, after all, there's an Aramaic idiom. Not the most powerful. Then we have the grapes idea, based on a very difficult drusha from Hazinu. Is that really even an eitz? Difficult. Then we have the esrog. Okay, maybe. Then we have the teina, the fig, because the fig leaf was what covered them. Not the most powerfully compelling opinions, let's be honest. If you add them all up, you maybe have one compelling opinion. I mean, in sum. in some. Now, why am I'm stressing this, not only because I think it's a fair and critical reading of the Medrash, because I think that it explains the continuation of the Medrash. Because there's one last opinion in the Medrash. Rav Azariah, Rav Yehuda bar Simon, b'shem Rival Omar, Chas v'shalom, critical about all of the four mentioned opinions. You're all off base and inappropriate. Lo gila kadosh baruch hu osa ilam adam. If the Torah wanted us to know what the tree was, it would have told us. Lo osa leglaso. We didn't know, and we're not ever going to know. It's not our purpose to know. After all, he draws the following interesting comparison. If you'll forgive me for the example, but it is a pasuk in Chumash. If a person would commit an act of bestiality, intimate relations with an animal. So what's the halacha? The Torah tells us explicitly, if a person gets killed, as does the animal. So look at the continuation of the Medrash. At the end of that third line, im adam chata, behema ma chatas. Okay, the person that we kill, okay, but why do we kill the animal? The animal is not what we would call a ba'al b'chira. They're not responsible for their actions. Ela shelo tehe behemo veres b'shuk, because we don't want what's going to be. We'll kill this person, and the animal is going to go back to his owner, and we'll be walking down the street one day. Yomru, and what's going to happen, right? Some adolescent kid, and or for that matter, a gawking adult, will say, hiya behemo shenisko ploni al yada. You see that animal? That's the animal that so-and-so got a little too friendly with. And that's why, you know, do you remember Yankel? He's dead now. You know why? That's the animal. Right? It's a tremendous bizarion. It's a tremendous bizarion to the person. It's a constant reminder of something which is almost too horrific to even contemplate. Yet, not only did the Torah contemplate it, at least once a year, if you read the news, you hear about this. At least once a year. Not necessarily more than that, but at least once a year. These things still happen. Is horrifically disgusting as it appears. Says the Medrash in conclusion, the im al kvod toldosav chos hamakom, and if Hashem is so worried about the kavod of his creations, namely this man or woman who was put to death, and therefore we're worried about their kavod, and again, not just some person, it's a tremendous avarian, but we see this time and time again, that the Torah is very worried about the honor even of great sinners, who's still worried about their decency, their dignity, al kvodo, al achas, kama v'kama. So, on his own covet, again, the Medrash is saying something very profound. The whole story, which we'll get to in Perek Gimel, the whole story of Eitz Hadas being eaten is a prisa in whose covet? It's a denigration, it's an embarrassment to who? Perhaps Adam too. The Medrash is telling us very powerfully, it's an embarrassment to Hashem. Every reference to Eitz Hadas is a humiliation for Hashem. I created one world with one, at this point, one/two people or persons, with one rule. And on the first day, they violate it. Not so impressive for Hashem. Not so impressive. Every reference to the story is a b'chisa of the covenant. And therefore, okay, if you'll learn the story, you're learning Torah, okay. But you didn't want, you know, that every year when the first graders learn in school that it's an esrog tree, and then later that year, you know, on Sukkot, esrog is the Eitz Hadas. Figs, I don't want figs. That's where the aver happened. That would be a constant reminder in so many other contexts of this terrible bizarion for Hashem, says the last minute of the Medrash, and therefore, not only didn't the Torah tell us, but you're not going to guess it, and it's not going to tell us. Very, very interesting, both in terms of the perspective it lends on the whole chait, that it's not just an embarrassment for humankind, that our ancestors let us down. It's an embarrassment for Hashem. That's a very intriguing and an interesting insight, which I think this clearly opinion is asserting. And it's also interesting because it, you know, all of us, and especially in the world that we live in, but especially because generally Torah itself, Torah encourages inquiry and a search for knowledge. And there's almost like nothing we don't think we should understand. We should know everything. We don't know everything, those of us who are honest admit, but we should know everything. You know, just, you know, if it's being hidden, it's a cover-up. Is there ever a good reason why we shouldn't perhaps know something? Right? You hear this in the press all the time, right? There's no topic that the NSA should actually not tell us about. Right? The notion that maybe not everything we should all know, it's a foreign concept. By definition, it must be a cover-up. I'm not saying there aren't cover-ups. I have no idea. But that whole mentality is driven by a tremendous arrogance and a tremendous obsessive sense of Magiali, I should know. I have a right to know. I have a right to know everything. Nothing could be not in the best interest of me to know. And as I say, I'm not just using that in some secular straw man. To a large extent, it's fueled by Torah. Our whole focus is to be pro-knowledge and pro-questioning and pro-learning. But it's interesting, Dafka, in light of that, to realize, says this Medrash, in an allegorical and a hashkafic context, there's supposed to be limits. Maybe most things, yes, but not everything. There are things in which are intentionally left mysterious, not because Hashem wants you to put in the effort and the schwitzing and the base Medrash to figure it out, because some things it's better you don't know. Now, how often that is, and why that should be in this case and not in that case.
We have the Agil, probably worse than that. And nobody hides the fact that it was an Agil.
Or any other Agil, right? Okay.
Not only that we have the Parat Duma, which is Mahafer,
Right.
So
I don't know. I don't really have an answer to your question. I don't have an answer to your question. I'm curious if anyone here does. My only suggestion would be that apparently what's being hinted at is in those last words. The last phrase of the Medrash is definitely key. This story, and I guess you could ask why not other stories, and I'm not going to have a good answer to your question, but what the Medrash is clearly driving at is that this story is a bizayon for Hashem. Now, you could have said it isn't the Chede Egel. After all, he picked a nation, he gave them the Torah, and then they... Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Anyone want to do the Cheshbon, Alan? You're an accountant. Or Bernie. When will this year get to the Chede Egel? It took us a year to do 2.5 prakim, 1.5 prakim. When are we going to get there? So, Halavai, Hashem should give us all the health that we should be here to learn together in Tavarsha Kisisa. And then we'll, in this context, perhaps investigate. But off the top of my head, I don't have a good answer. I don't have a good answer.
Where did the guy get that as an apple?
Yeah. Oh, so you left that. You took away my punchline. I just wanted to add one last thing before we move on to the shir, which is, of all the opinions, what's one thing it's not? An apple. Now, maybe because, who wants the guilt of eating an apple? You don't really eat esrogs, and wheat doesn't look like wheat when we eat it. And I don't know, I'm not a fig person, so I don't care. But a delicious apple, who would want the guilt of knowing that you're eating... So I'm glad it's not an apple. I don't know where they got it from. I have no idea. Where Moshe had horns from, so we know where they got that from. It's easy to make that mistake. Carne oat, it's easy to make such a mistake. Where they got the apple thing from, I don't know. Where did they know that Yonah was in a whale? I don't know that either, right? None of those are in actual tradition, Jewish sources. We don't know what Yonah's fish was. Yeah.
Why would be a
Leviathan? Maybe it was a species that never...
We know it's a form of a fish.
But it got hidden.
We don't know what it is.
Right, it's hidden.
So why do we have to know that it exists today on Earth?
I think that you're reframing the machlokas and the medrash. Now, the last opinion is, in essence, to a certain extent, saying what you're saying.
Would we be allowed to eat it?
I presume... Well, according to the first three opinions, the answer is yes. Why? Why shouldn't it be allowed to eat?
So at what point? Because we ate it once, right.
Right. Came with your hotter. I don't know. Good question. Good point. Maybe that's not exactly what the last opinion said, but I think both of your points perhaps are fair to be included in that context. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Right. Did the Chet Egel change the world? Probably not. What did, though, was the Chet HaMeraglim, right? This Parsha HaShavua. Right, that literally changed the course of history. The Meraglim changed the course of history.
You get punished for in every generation. You don't live forever.
From the Eis Hadas?
No, from the Egel also. Supposedly, after Matan Torah, you were going to go back.
Well, because the Meraglim, we would know. Without the Meraglim, we would have gone straight. The Mepharshim of Mepharshim said we would have gone straight into Eretz Yisrael, Mashiach would have come, and right. That's maybe what Alan means. We would never have had going back to that.
There's a Gemara that after Matan Torah, they were supposed to live again, just like before.
But I think that's connected to what I'm saying. I think it's connected to what I'm saying. Oh, not in the Meraglim. Not Meraglim. Right,
you're saying.
Oh, okay.
You know,
know?
Yeah.
Could it have anything to do with the fact that Shem had such a direct connection to Adam that he was the only one
yeah. who got the message? You could definitely make the case. And I think Rosemary's point is would be part of that case. You could definitely make the case why this is singular and unique. You know, I'm not saying that there aren't other cases which could have been candidates. Right, and listen, there's nothing. Yeah, and to paraphrase, right, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. Like maybe it's just because it was the first. After all is said and done, this was the first mess up. Everything else is, you know, just following a pattern that was already established. Nebuch. So before, you know, this was the first time the close relationship, the concept of sin was invented. I mean, a lot of bad stuff, right? We don't. In Mirtz Hashem, next year when we get to Paragimel, we'll have to see, you know, we don't, may not go as far as the Christians with the original sin. But that's not to be confused with the notion that we don't believe that something irrevocably happened. We do believe. Different Mepharshim argue about what happened with this chait, and it may not be the Christian version of it, but it was a singularly transformative moment in human history. And again, it's interesting that there's a certain amount of cover-up that the Medrash is endorsing. We shouldn't, you know, we don't need to know every detail about such an embarrassing episode.
In Haraya, after all is said and done, Hashem basically restricted access to the crime scene forever.
Right, right. Oh, good. That's another point, right? That's a related point, right?
It remains a mystery.
Right, right. We don't know where the Chet Egel, right? We don't have the Gan Eden now. Good.
Well, it exists. But
we don't know where or what it is exactly. Good. Okay, let's move on. We can move on. I have other good stuff to share with you. So, where were these trees? I want you to tell me, where were the two trees? Where were the trees?
So
look at the pasuk. Look at the pasuk.
In the middle of the garden.
Now, in the middle is the other tree. Eitz Chaim is in the middle.
Look. The Eitz Chaim b'soch hagan, the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra. Where were the two trees? This is a very difficult puzzle. It is deceptively simple. It starts off so nice. There was pretty trees, and you could look at them, and they were delicious. But by the time you get to the end of the puzzle, you don't know what's going on. Where were the trees? Where were the trees? So some of the Rishonim do discuss this, and they seem, despite the difficulty in the puzzle, they seem to nevertheless take as a exegetical, as a pshat axiom, that they were both in the middle. If you take a look, for the sake of time, I'm going to paraphrase, but you look at both the Ramban here and the Rabbeinu Bachai. Rabbeinu Bachai is very clear. He explains how, on the one hand, it doesn't say where the Eitz Hadas was. It only tells you that the Eitz Chaim was in the middle. But then he points out, Mimashe Hizkir, I'm on the second line of the Rabbeinu Bachai, skip the Ramban for a moment, in the middle of the second line. Because it uses the word B'Sof Hagan, that phrase, Bein Eitz Chaim Eitz Hadas, the Torah specifically placed it in between the two. Anu Mevinim Kishneim Hayu Bavadai Sof Hagan. They were both there. Or if you look at the Ramban, he points out, why didn't it say Bagan? Why does it say Besochagan? So that implies that it's in the middle. Then what about the other one? The center. So he assumes, again, Besoch could mean inside of, just like in English. It could have been inside of, and it could have been in the center. To be in something. So in the middle, if you say I'm in the middle of the crowd, right? It could just be within, or it could be mamish the middle. So these Rishonim see the Soch to mean not just in, but the center. And they seem to assume, and they point out, that the Targum Unkelus seems to imply this as well, that it was literally the middle. Well, what's the problem with that? Okay, let's assume. You'll grant the Rishonim that's the way to read the Pasuk. Okay, we read the Pasuk. So we take a step back, we breathe, we know how to read the Pasuk. What's the next thought that comes into our mind?
Two things can't be in the middle.
It's impossible! So, you're bending over backwards to fit it into the pasuk for what? It's impossible. And in fact, the Mefarshim point out, they quote that mathematicians they reference the fact that the scientists have already taught us that it's impossible for two things to be in the middle. Only Hashem could, so to speak, you know, balance two things on the eye of a needle. But we can never have any sense. Even if it was directly in the middle, could that be? Adam couldn't have seen that they're both in the middle, because by definition, two things can't be in the middle, certainly not to human comprehension. So, the Ramban gives the following suggestion. The Ramban has, and I'm going to just paraphrase it, it's the part that I've underlined here. The Ramban says, it's like, for example, we say in our shul, we are Makayim, so to speak, and this is a good image for you, that the Aron, the Bima should be in the middle. So what do we have? We have like a whole big platform. We even have a little bit of a railing. And the Bima is in that. So that area is in the middle. Says the Ramban, there was a garden within the garden. There was an area which was essentially like a donut, right in the middle of the garden. And that was the Besoch Hagan. That was the middle of the garden, that area. Within that area, there were two trees. Which one was on the left, which was on the right, he doesn't tell us. Were they exactly like this next to each other? Was one on one side of this little fenced off area and one was on that side? He doesn't tell us because it doesn't matter. The Torah says they were in the middle because they were in this cordoned off area. He mentions here, Aruga Achas Suga. It was, right, Suga Bashoshanim, as the more famous phrase in Arim. It was sectioned off, almost like a fence. There was an identifiable area which was, quote, the middle of the garden. Right, there's certain sections right in the middle of like Central Park. You know, this is the carousel area. This is the middle of the park. It doesn't mean that each one was in literally the middle. That's the Ramban's resolution. Rabbeinu Bachai actually has a more fascinating and I think potentially hashkafically significant answer. Rabbeinu Bachai tells you the following. At their root, who wants to guess? There was only one tree. There was only one tree. In the ground, there was only one trunk. And as it grew up, it had two different heads, I guess. Take a look. We'll read the one line in the inside. Even though there were two. You can't have two trees in the middle. At their base, in the ground, there was one. And only as they grew out was there two. Ki chiburon echad milamata. They were connected once underground. V'holchim umispardim lamala. As they grew, they disassociated, they disconnected. U'v'chein hayu shneihem v'emsa'us hagan mamish. For those of you who heard Rabbi Rudzinski 2 years ago, I'll paraphrase him. That's a Munsee word. But he didn't realize that the Rabbeinu Bachai already was using this. He didn't live in Munsee. Right? Mamish in the middle. Mamish, what? Rabbeinu Bachai was actually a Shtugel philosopher. He wouldn't have been so welcome like would it. But he would have was a little bit iconoclast. But it was Mamish in the middle. Mamish in the middle, says Rabbeinu Bachai, because it was one root, one trunk, and then they split. The symbolism and the significance of these two trees, different on the one hand, but combined, I think is very significant. Even though it's different, to me, it's very much in the spirit of the idea I want to share with you now. I'm going to paraphrase for you because it's very easy for you to read inside. It's from a drusha. This drusha was given by Rabbi Lamb in 1976. Who knows what happened in 1976? Only to be fair, I'll ask the YU alumni in the room. What happened in 1976? I'm going to revoke your alumni card if you don't know this. Rabbi Lamb became president in 1976. This is from his installation address. Rosemary, you put him all to shame. Rosemary, guess that's the good news. The bad news is you will soon be getting calls from the alumni office for donations. That was in Rabbi Lamb's installation address. He has a very, very beautiful speech. Again, you have to realize the context of the address. He's discussing he's the president of Holy Yeshiva University with his 15 affiliated graduate schools and colleges and medical schools and sociological schools and law schools and yeshivas and Stern College and the high schools and the Central and MTA and all that stuff. He's giving this speech with hundreds if not thousands of people. He makes the following point towards the end of the drasha. What is the famous phrase from Mishlei? We refer to Torah as Eitz Chaim Hi L'machazikim Ba. Isn't that strange? If you had to pick which tree would the Torah have been referred to? A Torah, the ultimate cerebral intellectual exercise. Why isn't it the Eitz Hadas? Why does Shlomo say it's Eitz? So he answered that question based on a comment of the Zohar. The Zohar says that in the Eitz Hadas, inside, was another tree. Not the Eitz HaChaim, just the opposite. To use the Aramaic of the Zohar, the Idlana Damasa, or Damata, the tree of death. What is the significance of that? And he doesn't quote this Rabbeinu Bachai. I assume Rabbi Lam knows about it, but he didn't quote it. But if I was him, I would have quoted this. Or if he republishes the speech, I'd footnote this. Because it's especially beautiful, I think, in light of this Rabbeinu Bachai. When you have the Eitz Hadas with the Eitz HaChayim, namely, and this is the major thrust of his speech, was that a college and a university can't just be about biology, can't just be about law, and even it can't just, quote-unquote, be about Torah. It has to be about using that knowledge, especially Torah, but even the other knowledges, to perfect ourselves, and then to perfect the world. Again, you have to realize the context of universities, especially then, but even to a certain extent now, where there's all sorts of, some of the greatest immoral and unethical advances take place on university campuses. They're using all the das, but not necessarily for the right reasons. And that was his point, is that das itself is not life-sustaining. Das, separated from chayim, das, separated from creating morality, then even with all the knowledge, you have an ilana damasi, you have a tree of death. Then you're going to lead to even more destruction. The only way das can be intertwined with Eitz HaChayim is if the das is serving a higher goal, is helping morality. This is not necessarily apropos to anything we learned, but obviously related to what we're doing, and I think a beautiful drush, and anyway, he's right. It's a beautiful idea, and it's kedai to know that Zohar in and of itself. And again, to me, it has a certain resemblance to the Rabbeinu Bachai, even though, again, it's certainly not the same thing.
The problem with this, in terms of pshat, is quite obvious, because the problem here, each of these items is referred to as eight.
Hold on one second. Can you open that door? Put a chair there. Open that door. Put a chair there. What is wrong with this room?
There's no air.
Why not? Oh, is there no vent in here? Oh, that's a good explanation. Okay.
There is a vent right there.
Oh, I don't feel a thing. I don't feel a thing. Right. Okay, so. Okay. We only have a few minutes. We have a little more than 5 minutes to go. I want to get now to not so much the biological characteristics or where was the gun, where was the tree. What is this symbolism? What does the Torah tell? The Torah may not tell us what species the tree was, but what does it tell us about the tree? It's Eitz Hadas. Now that's not usually Tovara, that's not usually a description you'd give to a tree. That's not a botanical description. Good and evil is not usually describing a tree. So what is going on there? So that, it's a two-word phrase. We know what the word Tov means, we know what the word Ra means. The problem is we don't know what Tovara means when it refers to a tree. And this is a little issue in the sense of two little words, and it has been a conundrum, it has been a mystery for Rishonim, Chazal, Adayom Hazeh. This is a super-duper-duper question. So it's largely investigated in the context of Adam and Chava eating from the tree, but already some of the profound and important comments, specifically of Ramban, are noted on our Pasuk. Take a look at the Ramban here, Perek Beis, Pasuk Tes. So first of all, he tells us what we saw last week from one of the other Mefarshim, that it's a Chayim doesn't necessarily mean you would have lived forever, but Chayim Aruchim. As long as you should live a long life. Eitz Hadas Tovara, first line, Amru HaMefarshim, he's referring to the Eben Ezra and one or two others perhaps, but primarily the Eben Ezra. What is this essence? What is this Tovara that you would now have that power if you ate the fruit, whatever fruit it was, of the Eitz Hadas? Moli Taibas HaMishkal. Sexuality. Sexual desire. Interesting, right? Of all things, that's what it was. That's the Eben Ezra says that, it's mentioned by other Mefarshim, and the Eben Ezra champions that view, that the essence of the tree, what's the result? A sense of sexuality. And therefore, koso marumehem achrei achlamimenu. Why all of a sudden? It was a coincidence that after they ate from the tree, they realized and were embarrassed about their nakedness? Was it a coincidence? No, because there was no sense of sexuality before eating it. But that was the potent power of the fruit, and therefore, all of a sudden, once they had that awareness, that characteristic, that part of their human personality and psyche, so then, all of a sudden, they realized, uh-oh, we're not in the locker room. There's a dress code, and we don't have any clothes. So then they grabbed the fig leaves, perhaps the fig leaf being the very thing that they ate from. Interesting, according to that pshat. That's the first opinion. The Ramban rejects this out of hand. Ramban brings all sorts of proofs. We don't have time to go into it now. Ramban rejects this opinion out of hand. And basically this idea That's not what the Torah ever says. The Torah kept on referring to a certain knowledge, ladas tov v'ra. The Ramban says, and that's what the snake tells them when they eat. And you'll say, maybe the snake was lying to them. But that's what Hashem himself says. Hashem himself says, now that you've eaten from this tree, and you now know tov v'ra. Doesn't sound like, says the Ramban, that has anything to do with sexuality. Rather, says the Ramban, four lines down, hayofa be'enai. Could be. Could be. Okay, good.
Maybe that's what they get.
Good, good. That's a good defense of the Ibn Ezra. Good. What does Ramban prefer? Ki adam hayoseh b'tivo mashroi la'asos kifi ha'toladus. Before the chait, people were naturally wired to almost automatically do what their natural inclination had them do. Kasher yasu hashamayim v'chol tzivav. Just like all the heavens and all the other creatures, they're implanted with a certain nature, and that's what they do. Pu'ulei emes shepulasim emes. And they only do what Hashem wants them to do. They don't do anything else. They're not doing things because they like it, because they don't like it. They're just doing it because that's what the heavens are supposed to do. What is the implication of the Ramban? That before the Eitz Hadas was eaten, Adam and Chava had no bechira. They had no ability to choose. Just like the Shemayim doesn't choose whether the moon's going to be out, it's going to be a cloudy day. It's just what it does. And therefore, he says, the fruit created within them the desire that you could choose what you want to do, good or bad or the opposite. So that certainly works with the phrase etzadas tovara. We now know what good and evil is, as opposed to beforehand when we were almost like automatons. Oh! You guys are sharp despite the heat. Excellent! Excellent. So many Mefarshim asked on this Ramban, and there are others who follow the Ramban, a lot of questions, but one of which is, if they had no Bechira, how could they have made a mistake to eat? Again, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, Paragimel, but as I say, the stories are obviously connected. How could they have done it? The Akedah Yitzchak asked that question.
Is a Bechira not one every
time? That's not what the Ramban seems to say. So we'll have to see, perhaps in Paragimel, other answers, etc. But I want to leave you tonight, and I don't want to go too late. So let me finish this up. Take a look at the last source of all places, from Rabbi Yeruchim Lubavitch. Rabbi Yeruchim Lubavitch was the famed mirror mashkiach. He's just known as Rabbi Yeruchim Mimir. Rabbi Yeruchim Lubavitch. So he has 3-volume work called Da'at Chachma B'Musar, very parent training, psychological Torah insights. And he has an essay where he discusses this, and he basically points out. I'm going to paraphrase for you. For the reason that was mentioned and others, the Ramban cannot mean what it seems. Cannot mean they had no Bechira and then they had Bechira, went from 0 to 100 in a second. That cannot be. He gives a mushal to what it does mean. He mentions that when he was a kid, there was a story they used to tell him about the Tamer Fakert. See the Yiddish there? Tamer Fakert. Tamer Fakert. You know, you've heard this?
No, I heard the expression.
You heard the expression. He says that there was a certain person who, no matter what you told him, guess what? The Orioles won today. Or maybe they lost. Did you know that there's a great Torah wave? Dafyomi is great. Or maybe it's horrible. It didn't matter what you told him. He was, you know, maybe it could be the other way. Maybe he'd figure out a way, right? It's Lahavdil, it's like a lawyer who's always looking at the other side of the case. Right? He was holding the gun and he shot the person and he admitted it. But maybe he didn't do it. And the lawyer can always see that other side. So, like an automatic. Says the Rabbi Ruchum, it wasn't that this person had any seichel. It wasn't a Renaissance man who knew every topic, and therefore could actually intelligently argue different perspectives on any topic. It didn't matter what the topic was. He was always going to give you, he was a contrarian. Says Rabbi Ruchum, this is in essence what the power of Adam had before the chait. The power, the literal power, literally, to do the opposite of what Hashem said, he had. But it would have been almost thoughtless. It would have been almost like, what would have been the point? If you wanted to do the opposite, you could. But there was no desire. He distinguishes between Bechira and Hechrechius. There was no urgent sense. There was no desire to do the opposite, in the way that now we have desires often to do the opposite of what we should. But technically, of course he could have. There was a certain element a bechira, but there wasn't a desire. He quotes from the altar of Kelm as a mashal to even this mashal. He says, in theory, any one of us, it's an apropos example considering the story we're going to read in Paragimel, any one of us could run out in the street naked. There's no one to stop us, nothing to prevent us, except for one thing. You'd have to be out of your mind. Who would ever do such a thing? Exactly the line that he used is, if you look four lines from the bottom, Adam Yochel Lelech Arum, you could of course go out in the street naked, but no one ever do such a thing. He asks rhetorically, but how could you do such a thing? You could, but how could you? You could, but how could you? Technically, is it true? And anyone who disagrees with me, please raise your hand with courage. Is it not true that every single one of us has bechira when this year ends in a minute to get completely undressed and go into your car and go home naked? Is it not true that every one of us has that bechira? Yeah. Is it even 1% of 1 milliliter, of 1% shayich that anyone would ever even consider having a half a minute to maybe in 1% of a million times ever do such a thing?
For you.
You would do it?
I can't speak for anybody.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, we've been together a whole year learning. I don't mean therefore you do it. I mean therefore we can assume that we know that people wouldn't do it. Right? Okay. So I'm waiting for someone, not to say you would do it, but you could conceive that we, so you agree with me that we have bechira to do it. But is anyone going to do it? So that is, says the Rav Yeruchim, that was Adam Kodem Achet. That's Shatan Ramban. Theoretically he had bechira, but it would have been as sensible as the Tamar Fakert. It wasn't, however, he says, the what changed, this is the important part. I don't know. Because women. Just kidding. I'm going home to one right now. But she doesn't see or hear the shear, so it's okay. Oh boy. You of course know that I'm joking. Zehu Derech Ha'riusam. We're almost, even though technically we have a choice to do this, but we're almost forced by habit, nature, whatever, not to do it. That was Adam before the Chait. Technically, he could disobey Hashem, but there was no reason for him to do so. But after the sin, and what does Bechira mean? It doesn't mean yes or no, because that he had that technical ability even before then. Nas Rav Shlomo, it means to say Nas Akilu Hu Bal Bechira Uber Shuso Uber Itso No Lahara. He would be filled with desire, perhaps. He still could control the desire, but he would be filled with desire to do good or bad. Lahitiv bein lo lebein acherim. Hainu shenifkasu lefanav psachim udrachim shiodeya davar v'gamim achol. Now he really senses, not just the guy who automatically says, maybe it's day, maybe it's night. Now he really understands why maybe you'd say it's night or maybe it's day. And once you really understand the opposite, then you might be tempted to go the opposite. So that dimension changes according to Rav Yeruchim, and that, he says, what the Ramban means. Doesn't mean there was no Bechira, because that's impossible, as per the question that was mentioned before, because then how would he have ever done the Chait? Now you still ask, no, but if it was so Tamar Fakert, if it was so meaningless, and there was no desire, so why did he do it? So, you know, that's the cliffhanger, Yitz Hashem, for Perek Yom.
Right. Yeah. First of all, why can't Tov HaRav be idiomatic? This is not the only place in Chumash where you have
a... So what is it referring to? Idiom of what?
I don't know, but it says here, in, for example, in Chayisara, with Eliezer is there with Laban and Tzua, and it says, we can't speak to you, Ra O Tov, number one. And Chayisara, again, it uses Vayetze, where Laban is chasing after Yaakov. Hashem has a dream.
Well, I guess
don't
I
talk to him Tov or Ra.
So I guess
small bays,
okay. So Gene, so you have to, presumably that's what Eben Ezra or others like him would say. The Ramban is asking it's to Eben Ezra. You can't say it means sexual desire because it doesn't fit into Tov or Ra. So part of the answer for the Eben Ezra or anyone else who has a similar shot would be along the lines of what you're saying, that the Ramban is taking it very literally. The Ramban is not assuming it's idiomatic.
But the Bechira that we're talking about, Hashem first of all said, eat from all the trees. Don't eat from this one. So Nochash didn't convince him. He said God didn't mean not to eat.
Right.
In other words, the choice that he was making.
Again, I don't want to get hung up on that because we haven't learned the psukim yet. That's okay. I'm trying to have my cake and eat it too.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just trying to give you an identification of what the tree was supposed to do. And again, you can't totally divorce it from what happened to Adam, because this Ramban already is connecting the two for obvious reasons. But we'll keep this in our back pocket, and we'll have to reanalyze this when we do that with more justice.
Okay.
Any other questions before anyone stops breathing?
Yeah.